All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I am your host, Aaron Freeman, and today I am doing my all 22 review of the Falcons Week 8 win over the New York Jets, answering many of your listener questions.
You are locked on Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Well, welcome back to this spooky episode of the Locked On Falcons podcast. I know that was a horrible, horrible, corny joke, but this wouldn't be Locked On Falcons if I wasn't super corny on this show. So we're going to do Q&A. You guys sent in a bunch of good questions this week. Probably won't last as long as the last couple of Q&As on these all 22 reviews. Also want to give you guys a heads up that we are giving away a free Pro Football Focus Edge subscription. I will give you the deets at the end of the show on how you can win that Pro Football Focus subscription this upcoming week. So let's jump right into it. There is a bit of a long-winded rant, and if I do a good job on time answering some of these questions, I will read that long-winded rant in its entirety at the end of the show. If not, then I'll just sort of skip around to the key points, and I hope that person is not too saddened by the fact that I did not read his 28-minute, his 2,000-word rant that requires. Okay, first question comes from Jean Kevin Hong. He asks, my question is, why didn't we trade for Marcell Dareus? It's pretty simple. That's not enough cap space. Luis Rodriguez. Hey, Aaron, just got done listening to your All 22 podcast. He's referring to last week's show. And I just wanted to point out that Raheem Morris was head coach in the NFL once upon a time, and I think he would be able to handle play calling on offense. Just saying. Well, Luis, I don't really buy this. That would then mean that Mike Nolan, Wade Phillips, and even Dan Quinn, since they've been head coaches in the NFL, would be capable offensive coordinators. And I don't know why anybody would believe that at this point in time. I think if you gave Raheem Morris an entire offseason from February through August to get prepared for the season and get things down and get prepped for it, then maybe, just maybe, he might possibly be able to do a halfway decent job. But, I think this is an example of people vastly underestimating what it takes and how hard it is to call plays in the NFL. I think the amount of information that you have to process and the things that you have to juggle, I couldn't even begin to explain it on this podcast. It's like, to me, it's like seeing someone going to the circus or something and seeing someone juggle and then thinking, oh man, I can do that. Like, no, you can't. You need hours and hours and hours, dozens, if not hundreds of hours to practice just to be a decent juggler. It's like, I play a lot of video games. I've seen a lot of movies. I've seen people fly planes. That means I know how to fly a plane. No, you don't. It's not something that I think people can pick up as easily. And I think people vastly underrate how big a learning curve. I think the evidence is staring us all in the face. You see it with Sark firsthand, that the learning curve from jumping from being a semi-successful college offensive coordinator to being a semi or very successful NFL offensive coordinator is a massive jump. It's the same jump that players make from going from college to pros. And yes, every now and then you have an Odell Beckham, you have a Deshaun Watson, but the vast majority of guys are a Justin Hardy, who takes 7 weeks before he can even get up to speed to be active on game days. The vast majority of quarterbacks are Deshaun Kizer, who look totally lost in their transition to the NFL, and people thinking that anybody can be the next Deshaun Watson is kind of ridiculous. You look at the Cincinnati Bengals. They fired their offensive coordinator earlier this season. He spent 13 years as their quarterbacks coach prior to taking over play calling duties last year. And he lasted, 20 games as their offensive coordinator? And he wasn't capable of doing the job? And he's got tons of experience. He's the son of a famous offensive coordinator in Ken Zampezi. Miami, Carolina, Tampa Bay, Denver, Arizona, all coordinated or coached by teams, by people that have a lot of pedigree as play callers in this league, and look at their offenses struggling. It's one of those things where I don't understand how people just really underestimate this learning curve, and I just think it's naivete. I mean, you talk about Raheem Morris. Back when he became the Bucks head coach in 2009, he hired Jeff Jagodzinski to be his offensive coordinator. That name is familiar. He was the head coach of Boston College when Matt Ryan was there. He also served as briefly as the Falcons offensive line coach in 2005 before moving on to be the offensive coordinator under Mike McCarthy in his first year in Green Bay. But he wasn't calling plays. He was just sort of like the guy that helps him coordinate his game plans on a weekly basis. And then, you know, he got hired by Raheem Morris after he got fired by Boston College in 2009, and he got fired by Raheem Morris that August after, you know, 6 or 7 months on the job, because they realized for various reasons that he wasn't cut out to do the play calling stuff. And they replaced him with Greg Olsen, the quarterback coach, and he took over the gig after a couple of years of experience calling plays previously in the NFL, and he wasn't particularly good. They had one good year, in that one year that Josh Freeman looked like a legit NFL quarterback, and then the other 2 years, the Bucs' offense was terrible. So why would we think, oh yeah, Raheem Morris, you know, based off of his ability to pick good offensive coordinators, his ability to coach a team that had pretty much bottom level offenses for 2 out of the 3 years that he was the head coach in the NFL, would be capable of being a good play caller, particularly if he was forced into the position mid-season with zero NFL experience calling plays and 1 year, 1.5 years of coaching offense in the NFL. Again, like Luis, I don't mean to pour it on you. This seems to be a popular sentiment. Last year, when everybody was still in Kyle Shanahan's the worst mode, they wanted Shanahan to get dismissed, and they were like, hey, let's have Raheem Morris do it. And after the season, when it was clear that Shanahan was, you know, towards the end of the season, when it was clear that Shanahan was likely going to move on, everybody and their mama was sitting there like, yeah, let's promote Raheem Morris to replace him. And I just don't get why people think that Raheem Morris would do a good job in that role. Maybe. I mean, but to me, it would be a massive gamble to put somebody in that position. And I, for the life of me, I don't understand why people think that. Clearly, I seem to be in the minority of that opinion. Well, guys, before we move on, as you know, this is an All-22 review. The reason why you like the All-22 is because you get all the angles. The other way of getting all the angles is being in the stadium itself. And if you want to be in the stadium, you got to buy tickets. And if you want to buy tickets, you got to use SeatGeek, because buying tickets to sports and concerts can be complicated, but SeatGeek is the better, simpler way to buy. It is the smartest, easiest way to get tickets to live events. With SeatGeek's seamless mobile experience, you can buy and sell tickets in just 2 taps, because SeatGeek helps you find the best seats at the best prices, fully guaranteed. There's nothing quite like seeing your favorite team or musician in person, and SeatGeek will get you closer to the action for a great value. I have a SeatGeek app on my phone, and it's by far the easiest way I find to shop for tickets. I can be anywhere, and with just a few taps, I can instantly find seats. SeatGeek is designed to make my ticket buying experience easier than ever, because SeatGeek saves me time and money by searching multiple ticket sites to compare prices and find amazing deals. And to get the most bang for your buck, SeatGeek grades every ticket based off of value to help you immediately identify the best seats that fit your budget. Plus, every purchase is fully guaranteed, so you can shop for tickets on SeatGeek with confidence. Make SeatGeek your go-to app to find the best deals on every type of ticket, from sports and concerts to comedy and theater. Best of all, my listeners get $20 off their first SeatGeek purchase. Just download the SeatGeek app, enter promo code LONFL today. That's promo code LONFL for $20 off your first SeatGeek purchase. All right, next question comes from Kristen at CVicNair9. He asks, what clicked for Matt yesterday that saw him make all those throws? How did the front seven play, especially the linebackers, factor against the run? You know, I didn't see anything specific for Matt Ryan. He just did a better job making some throws. He missed some throws. He made some others. That, you know, I don't think there was any sort of rhyme or reason to why he was missing throws. I said this on last week's All-22, talked about it. So I won't rehash all the stuff I said then. Just go back and listen to that. But yeah, like I don't think there was any rhyme or reason. He was just doing a better job making the throws. As far as the front seven, they had a solid game. They were certainly much better against the run. The linebackers were better with their run fits. I wouldn't say that they were good with their run fits, but they were certainly better. I think a lot of that has to do with the Jets offensive line being less effective, making those reach blocks at the second level. I think guys had more opportunities to run free and flow to the football and win some of those opportunities than they've experienced in recent weeks. So a solid overall game for the front seven, particularly against the run. Certainly the pass rush, I think, benefited from playing a weak offensive line as well, and you saw a lot more pressure on the quarterback to sort of affect things as far as that went. Bradley Knight at the Daily Ogre asks, is Julio Jones not getting open, and if so, why not? Maybe I'm reading a little bit too much into it, but it sounds like, Bradley, you might be in the camp of Julio isn't getting the ball enough. And similar to Luis's question, I don't quite get where that sentiment is coming from. Maybe it's his lack of touchdowns. Maybe it's his, his targets are, statistically his targets are down, but not to a huge degree. It's like maybe 10 or 12%. From where he was on pace last year at this time. The touchdown stuff, that doesn't bother me that much. You know, the Falcons have made a concerted effort the last two games to try to get Julio more targets in the red zone. And prior to the last 2 weeks, they were converting 60% of their red zone trips. The last two games, they've only converted 30%. Is that a coincidence? Maybe. Yeah, you be the judge. If I'm not okay, I don't think it's a coincidence. That's what I'll say. I'll give you my opinion, but I know other people will disagree with that notion. I would certainly say, prior to this past game, there was a downgrade in sort of how much separation Julio was generating, in my opinion, particularly against Miami and New England. I don't think that was an issue against the Jets. I would have argued that those issues would have been related to the injury, the back/hip injury that he suffered in the Buffalo game. But he was moving just fine. It wasn't that he wasn't getting open against the Jets. It was just the Falcons did a better job spreading the football around, in my opinion. And I think it reflected in the production of the offense. You know, I think, as I've said multiple times, I think when this offense gets too Julio-centric, it becomes a lot easier to defend, despite what people think about how amazing Julio Jones is. And he is an amazing player, but when you only have to defend one guy in the passing game as opposed to four or five guys in the passing game, it's a lot easier to do that when you can sort of, bracket him and give safety help to that cornerback, and it becomes harder for, the offense to function that way. Parker at Parks and Parks_die as tight ends were used more in the passing game, just good matchups. Why are we not getting big plays from special teams? I think the tight end targets went up because they were able to sort of create opportunities against the zone that the Jets were employing. And also they also got a couple of opportunities off of play action, which sort of opened up the middle of the field for them. So, yeah, I think there was a number of times where the Falcons were able to utilize their tight ends a little bit more. As for the big plays on special teams, I think the Falcons are right on track with the NFL norms. You know, looking at the numbers, league-wide this year, of the 401 return kickoffs, only 21 of them have been 40-plus yards, which is roughly 5.2% of the time. Roberts has one 40-plus yard kickoff return in 17 returns, which works out to be 5.9% of the time. So he's slightly above average there. That one return came against Buffalo when he had a 61-yard return. Of the 485 punts returned this year, 42 have gone for 20 or more yards, which is 8.6% of the time. Right now, Roberts has one 20-plus yard punt return on 10 returns. So that's roughly 10% of the time. So, again, he's above average there. When you look at the 34 return specialists that have returned a combined 12 or more kickoffs and punts this year, Roberts ranks 16th in terms of how many of those have been, big returns, which in this instance are kickoffs for more than 40 yards or punts for more than 20 yards. So, like, right now the Falcons are right on pace. I think, if it feels like the Falcons aren't getting enough big plays on special teams, it's because probably, Parker, your perception of how many big plays you should get on special teams is probably a little off base. This is part of the reason why initially when we signed Andre Roberts, I wasn't a big fan of the deal, because I don't think there's any reason for teams to significantly invest in their return specialists, just because, again, only a very small percentage of plays on returns amount for a big shift in yardage in terms of a big play. You know, again, for punts, it's 90% of the time you're not going to get more than 20 yards on a punt return. For a kickoff, for 95% of the ones that are returned, let alone the, you know, the 30 to 40, if not 60% of them that are touchbacks. So it's a very small percentage of plays that really really matter in terms of special teams returns that really can flip the field. So I don't think this is, you know, and then you factor in again punts, how many punts out of bounds, how many are touchbacks, how many are fair catches. It's probably like 30 to 40% of punts, you know, aren't returned at least. So again, it's a very small percentage. So 10% of the 50 to 60% that are actually returned. Again, it's 90% of the time who your returner doesn't really matter. So if you have an issue with the lack of big plays, I think, you know, there isn't really a whole lot of reason to have an issue with that. Right now, Roberts is giving the Falcons functional capability there, as far as we measure it league-wide. Next question comes from Dean Sabrizi, at Dean Sabrizi on Twitter. He asks, about what percentage of Matt's downfield completions were a result of blown coverages by the Jets? I would say a decent amount. There was a big play to Hooper midway through the first quarter that set up a touchdown where Marcus May and Robert Nelson were both out of position to defend Hooper on an out. They ran a clear out route with Julio down the field, which is a positive development for this offense. You know, people talk about Julio's usage. To me, it's not the number of targets he gets. It's more plays like that where they run clear outs. There was a later play where Sanu got a big play down the field where they ran a similar sort of clear out route, and Sanu sort of settled in underneath the Jets' Tampa 2 coverage. But in this particular play to Hooper, Nelson got sucked up by Devontae running into the flat. May's initial responsibility was playing single high in the middle of the field, but with Nelson not getting enough depth on his drop, it forced him to have to break over to try to defend Hooper, and it left Hooper wide open. You know, Nelson was more at fault on that particular play, and he made the mistake that often young defenders make in zone coverage, which is assuming that when a guy runs past you, oh, the guy behind me will pick him up, which is often not the case. And it's one of the reasons why I grow so frustrated when the Falcons play zone, because their players tend to make that mistake quite a bit, particularly their linebackers. The big play to Julio was certainly a blown coverage. That was an instance where Jamal Adams had single high responsibilities, but because of the play action fake in the backfield, he bit on that and basically left Darrell Roberts in the Jets playing cover three out to dry, with Julio running sort of that deep fly route over the middle, a post-go sort of combination route. So it's really impossible for the outside corner to cover that. He needs the safety help over the middle. That was a blown coverage, certainly. So several of the main big plays that the Falcons were able to generate were because of mistakes by the Jets in the secondary. Several of them were just, you know, the Falcons finding soft spots in the zone, not necessarily because someone was, you know, zigged when they were supposed to zag. Noel Rodriguez at Volta Noel 2020. This is an episode of all past Fan Talk people sending in their questions. So I appreciate that, guys. He asked, how do you think Ruben played and how he graded against the run? I saw him in almost every play, and I think he played well. A couple of people asked about Ruben. Young Zach, I think, had a similar question about Ruben. I thought Ruben had a solid game, just like I think everybody across the Falcons front had a solid game. You know, I won't go as far to say that, you know, Ruben made the difference. You know, I think our guest on yesterday's recap episode, Eric Robinson, sort of implied that a little bit with sort of his praise for Ruben. I wanted to sort of double check the film before I made either such a declaration that Ruben was a big reason why the Falcons' run defense improved, or to dispute that. And right now, watching the film, I would dispute that a little bit. I think it's a clean, sort of neat narrative where you would be like, oh yeah, the Falcons signed Ruben, they played him, and all of a sudden their run defense got better. It's easy to draw a correlation between those two. But I think when you actually go and watch the film, you know, Ruben had two or three solid plays. It was one or two plays where he did a nice job creating some pressure by pushing the pocket up the middle. And I think he did wind up getting a hit on the quarterback on at least one play. And then there was a couple of plays where he did a nice job holding the point of attack and sort of helping out with the run defense. But outside of two or three plays, I wouldn't necessarily say that Ruben made a huge, huge impact on how the front played and how the front performed. I wouldn't necessarily say that the reason why the linebackers seemed to do a better job is owed primarily to Ataba Ruben any more than I would think that Grady Jarrett and Don Terry Poe did. I thought both those guys had a really good game in the interior. I thought Shelby continued to shine as a run defender. I thought even Tack and Claiborne certainly popped on two or three plays as far as their ability to win in run support as well. Brooks Reed continues to be solid as well. Neal was very active in the box. So attributing anything to, you know, the uptick in good play to Ataba Ruben, I think is sort of people trying to make something out of nothing. I don't want to diminish Ataba Ruben's performance. I think he had a solid performance. But I probably, if I was, you know, ranking, you know, the Falcons' defensive line in terms of their overall performances, Ruben probably wouldn't be in the top five guys. So I don't think we should correlate to team success. I think if we're going to make that correlation, and this was sort of what young Zach was asking in his Twitter question that was very similar, I think we're correlating it to the Jets having a bad offensive line. When you have all of your defensive linemen having good performances across the board, I don't think it's because Ataba Ruben suddenly joined the locker room and guys were inspired to play well. And then when you factor in the improvement of the Falcons linebacker core and couple that with the Jets offensive line really sort of struggling to win on the second level and not being able to make those reach blocks, I think it speaks more to the Jets offensive line struggling. I don't think it's a coincidence that the other game where the Falcons run defense performed its best was against the Detroit Lions. And if you look at Football Outsiders' metrics, they have the Lions currently ranked as the 32nd best offensive line in the NFL. I think they have the Jets at 24. The only other bad offensive line that the Falcons have seen comparable to either one of those teams is Miami. And we saw that they struggled in the first half, really stopping the Dolphins' running game. They got better in the second half of that game. But for the most part, if we're going to attribute it to anything, I would attribute it to the Jets having a bad offensive line. I know four of their five starters have very low grades from Pro Football Focus this year. It's basically Kelvin Beachum and a bunch of nobodies at this point. You know, it's Kelvin Beachum and a bunch of Ty Sambrelos and Mike Persons. That's essentially what they are grading out as this year. So with that being said, I think if we're going to attribute anything to it, don't go too far. Pump the brakes on the Ataba Ruben hype train a little bit. Again, solid performance, but let's not necessarily make that correlation and that correspondence to his presence being the difference in the Falcons suddenly having a good run defense. Aaron C. Will, another Fan Talk guru, his question is, also, what's the deal with the Falcons receiver? Matt is holding the ball way too long. What's the malfunction? Certainly, I thought there was a couple of plays where Matt Ryan didn't pull the trigger to throw. The main one came at the end of the first half where the Falcons had multiple options open available to Matt Ryan. He could have tried to thread the needle to two receivers down the seam. Looked like that's what he wanted to do. He also had some underneath receivers in the flat that he could have hit. But, you know, he had a fairly clean pocket on that play, and for some reason he didn't pull the trigger. He got happy feet on that play and didn't pull the trigger, and Wilkerson was able to eventually track him down for a sack, and that sort of closed out the first half. You know, there was another play later in the earlier in the second quarter where the Falcons were backed up near their goal line, and Schweitzer got bull rushed by Wilkerson, and Matt Ryan didn't pull the trigger. He could have made a throw to Toy Lolo with pressure in his face into the flat, but he didn't. He sort of ate the ball and then tried to step up, and because of the collapsed pocket, he was forced to sort of throw it away and sort of threw a pass in the direction of Hooper, and it wasn't counted for intentional grounding. And, you know, I would say that's probably the reason, for those of you wondering why the Falcons later in the game backed up in their towards their goal line, decided to run the ball a second time up the middle to Tevin Coleman. That play earlier play where they decided to pass the ball on second down instead of running the ball and Schweitzer got wrecked is probably the reason. So, which is, again, another reason why I tend to think roll my eyes. When people a lot of the criticism that people levy at play calling, to me, sort of dismisses this type of information. That if you were aware of this type of information, you would be less critical of play calling from time to time. Yeah, I mean, it was a couple of times where Matt Ryan seemed to show not ideal pocket presence, but for the most part, I thought he did a good job sort of moving around and extending plays with his legs, you know, certainly better than he has done on average over the course of his career. So I don't think it was a major issue. It was just a couple plays here or there. Again, as I've said multiple times on this podcast over the last, you know, over the weeks, over this season, when I'm being critical of Matt Ryan, for the most part, we're nitpicking a couple of plays here or there. As far as the Falcons receivers, I don't think there is a deal. If there's an issue with the Falcons receivers, I don't think it's because of their inability to make plays. I think it has more to do with sort of the lack of sort of complementary route combinations of using this receiver in order to pull coverage away from this other receiver in order to open up wider, bigger windows. I think we saw more of that this week with Julio being used in that role. I don't think we've seen as much of that this year as we were used to seeing, particularly last season. And so if there's any issue with the Falcons receiver, I think it's more a function of design than a lack of ability, in my opinion. But at the same time, I've also said various times that I don't think the Falcons receivers are necessarily great at sort of winning one-on-one, you know, at least relative to what they need to be in order to function at a high level in this particular offense, given its lack of complementary route combinations. But yeah, you know, that kind of, you know, none of these, you know, it's Julio Jones, and then there's a big drop off to the next guy. And if you're going to run that type of offense like the Falcons did in the Cutter years, you need to have a Julio Jones, a Roddy White, and a Tony Gonzalez all in the prime of their careers, in my opinion, to really make that type of offense really work at a high level. And you see around the league when teams don't have that core of wide receivers, don't have three of the 12 to 15 best receivers in the NFL, it doesn't necessarily work to a high level. But yeah, I don't know if that's what you were looking for, Aaron. Lindsey Broom, at Lindsey_Broom on Twitter. Is it just me or are the refs extra tough on us this year? I would say, Lindsey, it's probably not just you, because I think every fan in every NFL city feels like that, probably thinks the same way. But I don't think the refs have been extra tough on us. I think, as you may or may not know, I've expressed this previously on the podcast, I tend to be a little less harsh on officials because my grandfather was a high school and college official in Virginia when I was growing up. And so because I have that sort of personal connection, I don't look at refs as these sort of faceless monsters out to get us. But, you know, I see it's a very hard job. As to the quality of officiating, I think there's no doubt that the quality has declined in the NFL over the years. I believe it was 6 or 7 years ago prior to the replacement official debacle. But I remember the NFL back when they were first getting criticized for poor officiating, the NFL, whatever that year was with the Ed Hockley thing, that's probably when it came out. I feel like that was like 08 or 09 when there was a Chargers-Broncos game. And there was a really bad call by Ed Hockley, and he had to publicly come out and admit he made a mistake. It was either that year or a year or two after that. So that would have been at some point in the last 10 years, but 6 or 7 years ago. Anyway, the NFL basically admitted that there was a 3% margin of error in terms of their officials making the right calls. And over the course of 130 plays or so a game, that's basically amounts to about 4 missed calls per game. And that was something, you know, and I would say that was something that the NFL was willing to admit and open to admitting. And so you could probably argue that there may have been, that rate should have been 2 or 3 times higher if a quote unquote objective third party was to look at it. And now since the issue with the replacement refs and the officiating has been particularly poor, in my opinion, over the last 3 or 4 years, you could probably argue that that rate is probably 2 or 3 times higher than it is. So, I mean, you're probably looking at something like a margin of error in a typical NFL game today that's probably 10 or 15, potentially, up towards the 10 or 15 plays where the officiating is not up to par. I would argue that over the course of a 16-game season, it's probably going to balance out for all 32 teams. So all 32 teams will get screwed, as they say, an equal amount of times, and or at least over the course of multiple years, it'll balance out. My personal stance on officiating at this point is, like, given the overall lowered quality, it's something that you'll just have to accept at this point in time, and an NFL team and a football team has to find ways to adapt to and overcome those issues. And I think the hope is nowadays that you would hope your team is good enough or plays well enough that any sort of missed calls don't wind up having a significant outcome on the outcome of the game. But there certainly does seem like to be a higher amount of times where the outcome of the game seems to hinge on a critical call, much higher today than it was 5 or 6 years ago, when it seemed like that would maybe happen a half dozen or so times a year. And now it seems like it seems to happen a half dozen times every week. You know, that may be a little bit of an exaggeration on my part, but it does seem like it has switched to multiple times a week, at least 1 or 2 times a week, where a big officiating call seems to affect the outcome of a game, or at least is perceived to, when that seemed to be something that would happen maybe once or twice a month or something like that. Certainly not every week in past years. So, yeah. I mean, that's a long-winded way of me saying, Lindsay, I don't feel like the officiating has been especially bad for us this year, but it's one of those things where, yeah, there's been a couple of calls the last couple of weeks where I've been like, really? Okay. You had the non-pass interference call on Julio against New England when Daron Harmon interfered with him. I think that should have been a flag. There was a non-pass interference call on Julio this past week in the Jets game where they picked up the flag because they said it was uncatchable. But that was basically the same call that went against us in the Lions game with Marvin Jones going against Desmond Trufant. And at the time, I argued that I thought it was a catchable pass, and I still believe it was a catchable pass. And I thought the Julio play was a catchable pass, but the officials in this game felt otherwise. Who got it right? I would argue that the Lions officiating crew got it right and the Jets officiating crew got it wrong. But maybe other people feel opposite. It's been tough, but I don't think it's been especially tough for us anymore. So, I mean, if you saw that Austin Seferian Jenkins play 2 weeks ago with the Jets against the Patriots, like, I don't think any call against the Falcons this year has been as iffy as that one, even sort of the sack strips, right, that went against us in the, what was it? Was that the Bills game or the Lions game? I can't remember. And then it happened the following week in whoever we played the week after or whatever. I can't remember the details. Miami, I think it was. So, yeah, it happens to everybody. So I don't feel like the league is out to, you know, certainly I wouldn't buy into the conspiracy theory that some people tend to push when they tend to get frustrating with officials that, you know, the league is out to get the Falcons. I certainly wouldn't buy into that, but The league is out to get everybody. That's what I would say. All right. So, 35 minutes. I guess we're good enough on time that I will read Charlie Rogers' rant in its entirety, and I will leave you with that. I don't have any response to what Charlie's going to say, but because you guys have listened to my rants, I will allow you guys to listen to other people's rants. So Charlie had a response after last week's All 22. After listening to the All 22 podcast, I have a rant of my own. I've been holding it in, but I'm going to let it rip. First, I love Matty Ice. He has missed a lot of passes this year. He looks extremely uncomfortable, and I think that causes his mechanics to go awry. He needs to have confidence in his line and his ability to make the throws he needs to make. Just make the throws, Ice. Multiple exclamation marks. Second, our defense is extra vanilla. They are no big plays, big stops, or turnovers. Third down defense is horrible. We cannot get off the field. We also give up too much yardage on first and second downs. Our defense is better, but really, how good is it if you can't make a stop? Losing Crawford hurts a lot, and the loss of Hageman to foolishness and stupidity has badly hurt our interior D-line. I really thought he was trending up, but we don't need people who harm women on our team. We need third down sacks, turnovers, and three and outs. We are getting none of them. Unfortunately, we rely squarely on our speed and physicality. Well, that isn't enough. We have to be more aggressive, whether it's via the blitz or stunts, make a stop. Third, our offense is too predictable. I could devise a plan to stop us. I don't understand how we didn't utilize Hooper against a poor New England defense, run downhill more, and just execute better. While most people want to blame Sark for our offensive woes, and I have a few concerns, execution is a bigger problem. We have got to make our blocks hit the holes, run sharp routes, make the proper reads, make the throws. Execution has been just as bad as our defense's lack of getting off the field. Please, guys, get it together. Now, as far as play calling goes, I have an issue of only a handful of plays. The third and fourth down calls at the end of the Buffalo game were terrible, particularly the fourth down call, a two-man route without Julio or Sanu. Come on, man. Against New England, we have a third and half yard to go, and we line up in the spread. That play call was just as bad as the next one was. What's wrong with A, running the ball off tackle or up the gut, or B, trying quarterback sneak? Is Ice too scared to try one, or is the coaching staff? Put the big boy pants on and strap on your helmet, and let's find out. A jet sweep on fourth and goal, that was the worst call I've seen us call in a while since the Super Bowl. Those two plays were definitely plays college coaches would call. We are not in college. Man up, damn it. Finally, for all the fans that think Sark should be fired after six games, what's wrong with you? Certainly you have better knowledge and wisdom than that. Patience is important here. I don't know if Sark is the right fit for us, but we have a small sample size and we are 3-3. I believe that our poor execution is the problem, not the offensive coordinator. Give him time and he ought to turn out to be fruitful. That being said, one has to wonder how Chip Kelly would have fit here. Well, my rant is over. We are a game out of our division and in the thick of things in the NFC with 10 games to go. We are undefeated in our conference and have the talent and skills to get better. One word, execute. So there you go, guys. That was Charlie Rogers' rant. He basically threw everybody under the bus, and I understand that. You know, certainly I have that feeling from time to time. I think overall, he's right. The team has to get better as an overall group. I certainly am not a huge fan of Sark's play calling and whatnot, and certainly when you compare it to Kyle Shanahan, it is very, very lacking. But again, as I've said before on this podcast, I don't feel like that is necessarily a fair comparison, because I feel like you're basically comparing, you know, the equivalent of play calling as far as we saw in 2016. That's the Aaron Rodgers or the Tom Brady or the Joe Montana of play calling, in my humble opinion, the Peyton Manning or the Johnny Unitas. Insert whoever you think is elite, an elite quarterback, excellent, all-time elite, sort of. And that's basically what the Falcons got in 2016, in my opinion. And, you know, Sark is, I wouldn't necessarily say the Matt Ryan of quarterbacks. He's probably more like the Matt Hasselbeck, and not prime Matt Hasselbeck, the Matt Hasselbeck that was getting up there in the years towards the end of his career in Seattle. And that's sort of what you're getting out of Sark. And yeah, there is a big drop from Joe Montana to old and busted Matt Hasselbeck. Certainly, but you know, old and busted Matt Hasselbeck is certainly enough to should at least keep you competitive on a weekly basis. He's just certainly not going to necessarily do the job that you want in terms of leading you maybe in the postseason or particularly far in the postseason should he get you there. You know, you need a Marshawn Lynch to do that for you, as the Seahawks had in that 2010 season with Hasselbeck and whatnot. So, yeah, that's what I'll have. That's my response to Charlie's rant. I have similar thoughts, basically. All right, guys, that's it. Not the shortest Q&A that we've had, and certainly not the longest either. As I said at the top of the show, Pro Football Focus Edge, we are giving away those subscriptions. All you got to do is go to Locked On Falcons on iTunes, give us a 5-star review, leave your Twitter handle in the review, and you will be entered into one random winner, be picked at the end of each week to win a free Pro Football Focus Edge subscription. Included in that is player grades, snap counts, position rankings, fantasy projections, rankings, tools and charts, NFL draft coverage, their scouting profiles, and more. It's a $40 value. It's a great value. But if you do not win that random drawing for a winner by dropping that 5-star review on Locked On Falcons, you can still get great Pro Football Focus content on the Locked On Podcast Network by listening to Locked On NFL every Wednesday, where Mike Renner will be appearing with the host Matt Williamson. You can check out Locked On Fantasy every Thursday with Vinny Iyer, and that's where director of fantasy for Pro Football Focus, Jeff Ratcliffe, will be making a weekly appearance. So there you go, guys. If you want to submit your own all 22 questions for next week's show, by all means, do so on Sunday, Monday, at any point during those days, and early Tuesday morning. It will certainly help me get those because I do the all 22 review. I record this on Tuesday afternoon. It is Halloween today. Doesn't matter. I'm rambling at this point. So how do you submit those? Then all means, like everybody else did, you can use Twitter. At FalcFans is my Twitter handle, but the easiest way to let me know it is a podcast related issue or topic or question or comment, then tweet at the show's Twitter handle at Locked On Falcons. If you don't like character limits, and apparently the reports or the rumors are that Twitter is going to expand to 280 characters for everybody in the near future, but if you don't like Twitter or don't have Twitter, then you can always email me those all 22 questions at lockedonfalcons@mail.com. Facebook is also where you can submit those questions. Locked On Falcons is the Facebook page. You can also leave a comment on falcfans.com. You can also leave a comment on lockedonfalcons.com, even though right now we are in the process of getting that website up to date. If you have not been listening to every episode, the last couple of episodes, and you may not have heard the word that lockedonfalcons.com is a thing, thanks to our partnership between the Locked On Podcast Network and FanRag Sports. You can find any number of NFL content in the various Locked On NFL podcasts on the Locked On insert team name here.com, Locked On Chiefs, Locked On Panthers, Locked On Packers.com, et cetera, et cetera. Locked On Falcons is now a thing. So, yeah, that's it, guys. I'm done. Not my best outro, but, you know, I'll do better on tomorrow's show. Tomorrow's episode should be a fan talk. The Friday show will be the preview this week, and then we will probably have an additional fan talk on Saturday. So in order to make up for the lack of fan talks the last couple of weeks, you will get two fan talks this week. So we will be talking Jets. I'm sure we will be talking Panthers. I'm sure we will talk about today's trade deadline. And the Falcons did not make a move, but several other teams, including the Panthers, made some pretty bold moves. I'm sure we will talk about the Kelvin Benjamin trade on tomorrow's episode. So stay tuned if you want my thoughts on that and whatnot. So there you go, Sky. Stay locked on. Rise up. Stay in brotherhood. All that stuff. Hashtag, I'm out.
You are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network. Your team every day.